Hi, this is Barry Listen Informs, the Institute for Operations Research in the Management Sciences. You're listening to Science of Better, a series of podcasts about ways that analytics and math modeling help people like you and organizations like your own. Remember the business giants DEC and Wang Labs and Borders and Blockbuster? Why have the mighty fallen? Does it have anything to do with shortcomings in analytics? Our guest today is Gary Kokens, a principal in a business consulting group devoted to analytics-based enterprise performance management solutions at SAS, a leading software vendor in business intelligence. Gary graduated in 1971 from Cornell University with a degree in industrial engineering and operations research and has an MBA from Northwestern University's Kellogg School of Management. The author of six business books, he wrote Obstacle Course for Analytics in the Informs publication ORMS Today that appeared last February. His most recent article for Informs in the current issue of Analytics Magazine is Why Do Large, Once Successful Companies Fail? Gary, welcome to the Science of Better.
Thanks for having me, Barry.
Your recent article begins with an example of the limits of people's rationality, then goes on to touch on the work of the Nobel Prize winner Herbert Simon. What's your point about the limits of human thinking and decision-making?
Well, there's been it's a popular topic, a recent book by Daniel Ariely on irrational thinking has become popular. The book's title is Predictably Irrational, The Hidden Forces That Shape Our Decisions. And I, you know, must manage your expectations. I'm not a psychologist. I'm just sort of interested in this sort of the topic as an amateur. But some of the examples that Dan Ariely gives is that individuals may have a headache and take a 1 cent aspirin and it won't relieve it, and then they'll take a 50 cent aspirin and it will relieve it. Another example he gives is that individuals will splurge on an expensive dinner, but then they'll clip, you know, a 25 cent coupon to save money on a can of soup. But I think here's an example that demonstrates the oddities about human thinking. There was a test involved people, providing people with a list of 10 questions, such as, in what year was Mozart born? The task was to select a range of possible answers such that you have a 90% confidence that the correct answer falls in your chosen range. Now, Mozart was born in 1756. So, for example, you could narrowly select the year 1730 to 1770, or you could broadly select 1600 to 1900. The range is the person's choice taking the test. But surprisingly, the vast majority of people given this test only chose correctly no more than 5 of the 10 similar questions with ranges.
Mm-hmm.
So why do people choose so poorly? It must be because they choose too narrow bounds of the range. So the lesson is that people have an innate desire to correct, to be correct, despite no penalty for being wrong. And this is, can also lead to basically bias. Bias can involve preconceived notions of what answer do you want, and then manipulating the analysis to prove the answer. And this will come into play when we talk about the failure of large companies.
And since you mentioned the failure of large companies, it brings to mind when I was a bookseller in the 1980s, one of the most popular business books was something called In Search of Excellence, and it talked about excellent companies. What do you find when you revisit the book 30 years later?
Well, of course, this is the famous book by Tom Peters and Waterman, their McKinsey consulting research, but I'll just first pose the question to the audience, what do these companies have in common? Amdahl, Cheeseboro Prawns, Data General, Delta Airlines, Digital Equipment, Kmart, Kodak, Levi Strauss, Braychem, Revlon, Wang Labs. They were all part of that book and passed the strict hurdles to qualify as superior companies. But today, they are either bankrupt or they are in deep trouble, Kodak being most recently.
Yeah, that's kind
but
of
I'll,
sad.
But I'll up the ante on you, Barry.
Okay.
Let me ask you this. Of
sure.
The Forbes 100 list that was created in 1917, how many do you think were on that list in the year 2006? And the answer is only 18, and only 39 have survived. And of the Standard & Poor's list that was created in, that's the 500 list in 1957, how many were on the list in 2006, only 74, just 15%. So it's pretty amazing. What does one conclude? My speculation is that when companies are too successful, it just breeds adversity to taking risks.
Yeah, I was going to ask you that in the sense that what does a company's willingness to take or avoid risk, in fact, its policy toward risk management teach us about the future health of the company?
Well, my observation is that there is increasing interest in the integration of enterprise risk management and with enterprise performance management, which we can touch on later.
Okay.
But there's confusion and lack of consensus about what each of them is, let alone how to integrate them. Finding the best way to apply meaningful measurements and analytics really adds to this problem with risk management. But most disturbing is recent research that shows that however interested in enterprise risk management solutions executives may be, they are not adequately funding these functions, possibly due to the fears that the extra costs will reduce profits. And in addition, they're not allowing risk managers a seat at the executive table. Risk managers do play a valuable role within an organization. However, by focusing on risk across the enterprise and mitigating the chance of potential risk to protect the organization's profits. Now, risk management is not about minimizing an organization's risk exposure. Quite the contrary, it's all about exploiting risk for maximum competitive advantage. However, a risky business strategy can carry a high price. Just look at this week's J.P. Morgan problem that resulted in their stock price decline of roughly 10%. Risk involves uncertainty, and uncertainty can include accuracy, completeness, compliance, and timeliness, in addition to involving predictions or estimates that can be applied to targets. All of these can benefit from applying analytics. Now, let me just end on this. Here's a provocative question.
Okay.
Are risk managers supportive of long-term profit growth, or do they present obstacles that may stifle it? Unfortunately, this topic has recently taken a dark edge. A report written by The Economist magazine's intelligence unit titled Fall Guys, Risk Management in the Frontline. In the report, a risk manager claimed he was fired for telling his company's board of directors that the organization was taking on too much risk. So did management want to ignore a red flag of caution to pursue higher profitability? This really involves whether strategic planners view risk managers as profit optimizers or profit detractors. I think the risk management people will win in the end. And
it sounds like they're being treated a little bit like whistleblowers or people who are challenging the corporation rather than trying to help it.
Absolutely.
I wanted to talk a little bit about how analytics fits in with everything that you've been talking about. And you write that companies have two options when it comes to analytics-based enterprise performance management. Essentially, those options are thumbs up or thumbs down. So what's the penalty when there's inaction?
Well, Barry, I think it's almost a rhetorical question. I mean, the penalty to not embracing change can be substantial. And I think change is really what it's all about. And part of the problem is it's human nature to like the status quo. So I think change management, altering people's behavior, is going to be a big task for people, whether they're in the analytics field or whatever initiatives that sponsors and champions are trying to take on.
And why is analytics so important for an organization's long-term sustainable growth, not just the short-term, of course?
Well, for the last few decades, many executives and strategic consulting firms have followed the framework of the popular Harvard Business School professor Michael S. Porter, the author of, you know, books about how organizations seek a competitive advantage. And Porter's writings include three types of generic strategies, and I'll describe the three, but notice that with today's clock speed and technology-driven markets and economies, each generic strategy that was advocated in the past is really vulnerable today. The first one is a cost leadership strategy. This is accomplished via improving process efficiencies, unique access to low-cost inputs such as low-cost labor and materials, vertical integration, or avoiding certain costs. But today, other firms using lean management techniques and data analysis methods can quickly lower their costs. The second strategy is a differentiation strategy. This one is accomplished by developing products and services with unique traits that are valued by customers. But today, there is imitation or replication of products and services by competitors, such as smartphones as an example, or changes in customer tastes. And the third strategy is the focus strategy. This one is accomplished by concentrating on a narrow customer segment with entrenched customer loyalty. But today, broad market cost leaders or micro-segmenters can invade a supplier space and erode its customer loyalty. So here's the point. Given these vulnerabilities, how will an organization gain a competitive edge? In my opinion, the best defense is agility with quicker and smarter decision-making, and this is accomplished by achieving competency with business analytics. They can provide that long-term sustaining competitive advantage that your question asks. You know, this means creating a culture for metrics, a culture for analytics in any organization.
Let me remind our listeners that this is Barry List of Informs. We're talking today to Gary Kokens, a SaaS consultant, on why companies fail. In your article, you have an interesting perspective on how people take mental shortcuts and where these break down, and this is significant to what we're talking about. It's related to the work of a Wharton professor, Frank Shurmans. Can you explain?
Well, similar to Dan Ariely's book on irrational decision-making, yeah, Dr. Frank Shurmans' research goes deeply into the nuances of cognitive psychology. A key observation he makes is that humans have limited rationality between our ears. Our brains were designed to hunt prey. So typically, people defer to taking mental shortcuts from learning by discovery and by past experiences. I think the academic term is heuristics. So, for example, a man decides to take an umbrella if the sky has dark clouds, but not if it is sunny. The clouds probably provide enough information for the umbrella decision. But is the man 100% sure it will rain or not? His conclusion is probably good enough for the umbrella decision. But does he know or just think he knows? And that same question also applies to organizations. You know, do you know or just think you know? So the umbrella decision is an example of the limits of decision-making. Mental shortcuts, gut feel, intuition, and so on typically work, but only up until problems get complex. So my sense is that companies begin to fail because their problems and opportunities have become very complex. The point is they address problems where there is complexity with insufficient information to make decisions.
One of the things you say in the article that I think is extremely useful is the way you address the issue of framing problems. Tell us a little bit about framing problems for corporations and where analytics fits in with all this.
Well, Barry, as just described, when problems do get complex, then a whole new set of issues arise. So systematic thinking is required. So what often trips people up is that they do not start by framing a problem before they begin collecting information that will lead to their conclusions. So there is often that bias or preconception that I mentioned earlier. Managers often seek data that will validate their bias. The adverse effect is, you know, we prepare ourselves for X and then Y happens. So by framing a problem, one widens the options to formulate hypotheses. Now, a misconception to information technology specialists, I believe, is that they equate applying business intelligence technologies, you know, typically nicknamed BI, with query and reporting techniques such as data mining.
Uh-huh.
But in my mind, it's much more, because in practice, I think experienced analysts don't use BI as if they're searching for a diamond in a coal mine. They don't, you know, flog the data till it confesses with the truth. Instead, what they do is they first speculate that two or more things are related or that some underlying behavior is driving a pattern seen in the various data. And then they apply business analytics more for confirmation than for random exploration.
So they're taking a scientific approach.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, this is the engineer in me with this belief. So what that really requires, though, for analysts, what they really want is to have easy and flexible access to the data the ability to manipulate the data and software to support their investigative processes. So without initial problem framing and a confirmatory approach, you know, mistakes are inevitable. Sadly, as Sherman observes, you know, many do not learn from their mistakes and they repeat them with more gusto. I want to clarify something about business intelligence and business analytics.
Okay, go right
ahead.
My belief
is business intelligence reporting consumes stored information, but then analytics produces new information from the stored information. And then ultimately, methodologies in the portfolio of enterprise performance management, things like customer profitability analysis, rolling financial forecast, probabilistic rolling financial forecast, risk management, and the like, they then deploy the analytics in the context of problems and opportunities.
One interesting thing that you look at in your article, it's the difference between things that are complicated and things that are complex. What's your point, and how does analytics fit in with this discussion?
Well, in my Informs article, I referenced a Harvard Business Review article recently published titled Learning to Live with Complexity. And the authors described the difference between something merely being merely complicated and generally complex. They suggested to think in terms of systems. So complicated systems have many moving parts, like a wristwatch, you know, with the tiny gears. But they operate in pattern ways. In contrast, though, complex systems have pattern ways, but the interactions, and think of them, these interactions as variables, are continually changing. So in the former, a complicated system, one can usually predict the outcomes. You know, the math may be easy with linear relationships. But in the latter complex one, like with air traffic control, weather and aircraft maintenance delays that are unpredictable to a point, they cause changes in the constant interactions with the numerous variables. So to make better decisions, the modeling and analytics need to be much more adaptive and flexible. They need to have self-learning capabilities, really, to get increasingly smarter. Now, in my opinion, as well as my employer, SAS, whom I think many of your listeners are familiar with,
I think so.
High-performance computing is creating a game changer. You know, high-performance computing reminds me of the line in the baseball movie Moneyball, which I really loved, where Brad Pitt, playing that role of Billy Beane, the Oakland A's general manager, he says this great line, "I want to change the game." And he did that by embracing statistics and analytics about how baseball games are won. So I think to conclude, companies that successfully use analytics to gain additional information and insights will outthink, outsmart, and out-execute their competitors. The progressive enterprises are building their strategies around information-driven insights that generate results from the power of analytics of all flavors, such as segmentation and regression analysis, and especially predictive analytics. You know, they are becoming proactive and not reactive. And Barry, I don't want to leave out the public sector as well. I know I've mentioned competitive advantage and competitors and so forth.
Right.
But my observation is there is really convergence between public sector government organizations and commercial ones in the use of methodologies. And so there's not this great difference. Some government people say, well, we're not a business. And I'll say to them, well, I grant you two things. You can't choose your customer, and your goal is not to make a profit. What else is different? They still have limited resources to solve difficult problems. So the use of these methodologies are converging, whether it's public sector or commercial.
And I might add that I think in the last month or two, the White House announced a $250 million appropriation for the exploration of big data within government, which obviously ties in very closely with what we're talking about.
Absolutely.
You write that chief executives have to ask one question about where the company's going and a follow-up question about how to get there that has a strong analytics connection. What are the two questions?
Well, my belief is the role of the executives is really, and I'll simplify this, to ask the first question, where do we want to go? And their job really is about giving vision and inspiration to employees and managers. But the role of the managers is really to answer the second question, how will we get there? What are the projects and the initiatives and the actions that we need to take in order to basically achieve those strategic objectives formulated by the executives? You know, the big frustration with executives is not formulating, it's really execution and pulling it off. And that's where analytics and some of the instruments in the enterprise performance management portfolio, scorecards, dashboards, KPIs, and the like, will play a significant role.
I thought we could turn briefly as well to your piece about analytics obstacle courses. And that article, you ask an intriguing question, which is, since analytics are so logical, proven, and beneficial, why is their adoption rate by organizations so gradual and so slow? What did you come to conclude?
Well, this slow adoption rate issue has really been bothering me the last few years. I mean, people who are familiar with my background know that I was fortunate, almost a Forrest Gump-type career. I got involved with activity-based costing in the 1980s with Professor Robert S. Kaplan of the Harvard Business School, and also with the balanced scorecard work of Dr. David Norton. And I thought within a few years it would just take off like a rocket, but it hasn't. But they're also not fads or fashions. It's just that the adoption rate is much more gradual and slow than I thought. So I've posed this to people that I talk with, and what I've observed is there's what I will describe as the four barriers. The first barrier is the technical barriers. Those are IT-related, you know, dirty data, disparate data sources and the like. But, of course, some of that can be resolved with extraction, transform, and load and other technical solutions.
Uh-huh.
The second barriers is, I think, perception barriers that, oh, boy, to put in these big management techniques or to apply analytics, way too complicated and way too complex. And I think that can just easily be resolved with just experience. A third obstacle is what I would call design deficiencies. Either the experiment was not created properly, or the cost accounting system wasn't reformed and designed properly, or the balanced scorecard KPIs weren't identified and so forth. But, you know, quite frankly, those three obstacles, I think, are all can be overcome. The big hitter, in my mind, is really organizational behavior barriers, which involve resistance to change, culture, leadership. You know, examples are fear of knowing the truth, not wanting to be measured, not wanting to be held accountable, weak leadership. I mean, the list goes on and on, and I find in some of my seminars, when I get to this point, all the heads begin to nod. Like, yep, that's the problem. You know, we've got. We know our techniques are proven. It's just we're having challenges getting buy-in up to the top and laterally across the organization.
One internal problem you identify is a clash of cultures between IT and analytics, and that's something that's often mentioned by people in the operations research and analytics field. What exactly is the problem as you see it?
Well, I think there's this big brick wall that separates IT and the business and the users. IT, in my mind, is a set of technologies where, in contrast, business analytics is really that more, that set of capabilities, that analytical sandbox. And, you know, IT worries about, you know, daily operations, batch processing, data storage and the like, keeping the lights on. Where, in contrast, I think analysts are really much more about discovery, investigation, and analysis. And the problem is, I think they view each other differently. The IT people seem to view the business analyst as a competitor. They solve, but they don't operate. They're an IT resource intensive. They're risky with low concern for governance and control. But quite frankly, they're a mystery of what they do to the IT people. But on the other side of the wall, I think the business analysts view IT as obstructionists. They're controlling. They're uncooperative. They're bureaucrats. They're less skilled than we are. They're just a service center. And of course, I'm exaggerating to make the point.
Right.
I think this is the opportunity for, and business analytics can really drive it, to provide IT that opportunity to truly drive value. But the two groups are going to need to be far more collaborative and flexible and tolerant of each other.
Final question, are you optimistic that more companies will realize the benefits of analytics?
Well, my wife says that I am a constant worrier but an eternal optimist, so I am going to land on the optimist side. I cannot think that any organization will not benefit from applying analytics. The opportunities are so enormous and they're so broad. I mean, just think of, I'll just sort of rattle through examples in retail merchandising companies. They've got markdown and assortment planning. In financial banks, at risk and loan credit scoring, pharmaceuticals, drug development, and clinical trials. Text analytics for sentiment analysis becoming a big deal for unstructured data. Fraud analytics in the insurance and medical claims area. Supply chain area, route optimization, manufacturing, warranty claims, predictive equipment maintenance. I mean, I think the list is just so broad, it's so huge. To me, the real challenge, but I'm optimistic, is, how will this be led? Who will lead it? And how will it be accomplished?
And that's a question we'll have to end with. That's all the time we have today. We've been talking with Gary Kokens of SAS. Gary, thanks for joining us.
It's been my pleasure, Barry. Thank you.
And thank you for listening to the Science of Better podcast by Informs, the Institute for Operations Research and the Management Sciences. For more about operations research and the series of podcasts, visit us on the web at www.informs.org. Good day, and remember, keep on crunching those numbers.